Hello and welcome to the inaugural Ricardian podcast brought to you by the Richard III Society. My name is Alec Marsh and I'm the editor of the Ricardian Bulletin, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to our podcast. The purpose of the podcast is to explore the contents of the latest edition of the Bulletin, the voice of the Richard III Society, and with hope to bring the Ricardian ambitions and scope of the Society to an ever wider audience. Joining us today, we have two eminent Ricardians. First, in alphabetical order, I'm pleased to welcome the medieval historian Dr. Joanna Lanesmith, author of an award-winning book on medieval queenship and biographer of Cecily, Duchess of York. In addition to being a veteran member of the Society, Joanna is a former research officer and is now both a board member of the Society and, since last year, the editor of the Ricardian, the Society's respected academic journal. Welcome to you, Joanna.
Thanks very much, Alec. It's great to be part of the first Bulletin podcast.
Great stuff. Second, I'm delighted to say that we are also joined for this debut podcast by Wendy Moorhen, the publishing editor of the Ricardian Bulletin. Wendy is also a long-standing member of the board of the Society and, of course, a former deputy chair and a former research officer too, as well as much else. Over the years, Wendy has contributed numerous articles to both the Bulletin and the Ricardian, in the case of the latter, dating back to at least 1993. She's also been a close watcher of Ricardian affairs for many years, as will become apparent. Welcome, Wendy, to the Bulletin podcast.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks, Ross.
Thank you, Wendy. Great stuff. Right, let's begin then. So, Joanna Lanesmith, you very kindly contributed the cover story of the March edition of the Bulletin, which concerns the Battle of Pavia, fought in northern Italy in February 1525. Could you begin by telling us why a battle fought between the King of France and the King of Spain during the reign of Henry VIII matters at all to those of us who are interested in the history and life and times of Richard III?
Well, yes, absolutely. Obviously, Richard III had been dead for 40 years by then, but the consequences of his life and his actions were very much still shaping the political scene for a few people. Because, going right back to 1484, after Richard's only son died, it was assumed generally that his next heirs would be the sons of his sister, Elizabeth de la Pole, a family who was still very much alive and well through Henry VIII's reign. So it's their story that we're looking at. When Henry VII became king, this family initially accepted the Tudor regime, but very early on, the eldest de la Pole rebelled and he was killed at the Battle of Stoke. So fast forward to the beginning of Henry VIII's reign, by which time two of the de la Pole boys, young men, were locked up in the Tower by then, but the youngest de la Pole, Richard, had been on the continent for almost a decade, moving between European courts, claiming to be Richard III's rightful heir. And he'd carried on living off pensions from European rulers, supporting French kings in their military endeavours, or even as their ambassadors, and occasionally assembling armies allegedly ready to invade England, and evading multiple attempts by Tudor servants to capture or assassinate him. So he was a real thorn in Henry VIII's side. But then, at the Battle of Pavia, fighting in support of the French king, Richard de la Pole was killed. And this meant that Henry VIII could finally stop worrying that one of his European opponents could use a de la Pole to kick him off the English throne.
Okay, there's a lot going on there. So,
yeah.
I mean, how many times do we think or know that Henry VII tried to have this, or VIII indeed, tried to have this guy, have this chap killed?
Well, it's we've got various letters that were sent with spies, or particularly Cardinal Wolsey was trying to orchestrate stuff. He's sort of recruiting people. Certainly, some of them are English, but some of them are foreigners. It's kind of a bit like a bounty on the head. Very early on, when Richard is living in Aachen, he writes this pitiful letter to his brother saying, "I've been told King Henry has told the inhabitants of Metz to kill me, sorry, Aachen to kill me." So, We couldn't put a number on it.
Okay. And how did he then end up kind of fighting on the King of France's side in 1525 in this Italian war that raged for 4 or 5 years? How did he end up on the side of France?
Well, because Francis I had promised to eventually help him to reclaim his throne that he was rightfully his. But he said, I've got to sort out my fight with Charles V of Spain first. And so de la Pole kind of threw in his lot with supporting Francis I on these Italian campaigns, and they were part of a very long siege of Pavia, first of all.
And so, I mean, is it just, he's not just rich on his own, he must like bring something to the party. Did he have a little army of his own, or I mean, do we know, or it may not be known?
So most of the people that he was leading were actually supporters of the French king anyway. They, you know, he was given his a command. Various noblemen have commands of men that either French or Italians that he's leading. He did have some English supporters with him. Occasionally, disaffected Englishmen had come out and ended up allying themselves with de la Pole as well. But I don't think that we've got any records of any of them actually being there at Pavia at the time. So it was just this. The Landsknechts, they were called, that he was charge of.
Okay, so when the battle was over, I mean there were like 50,000 people on the field and 1,000 French dead and wounded, of which Richard de la Pole is one, but also Francis I. So, which is obviously unusual for a king to die in battle, although
No,
obviously
he
it
didn't
happens in
die.
England.
He didn't die. Francis the
Oh, he
First was
didn't
just
die.
captured.
Okay. Oh right. Okay. So, oh, fine. So what? I suppose that leads to the question: what was the outcome of the battle? You know, parking Richard de la Pole for a second. What was the consequence of this big European fight?
Well, it was a terrible, devastating defeat for the French, and the most significant since Agincourt, really. And as I said, yes, so Francis I was captured, so was Henry, King of Navarre, and it put Charles V of Spain, who was already Holy Roman Emperor, in a really hugely powerful position. It brought the Italian War to an end, obviously, because Francis was unable to fight, and he was forced into a treaty where he had to give up not only his claims in Italy, but closer to home, Flanders, Burgundy. He even had to send two of his sons as hostages to the Spanish court. But ironically, what happened was that the Henry VIII suddenly became very alarmed at the amount of power that Charles V now had in France, sorry, on the continent. And so he allied with France to an extent in which they both promised that neither would ally independently with Charles V going forward. So it really shifts the balance of alliances across France, across Europe.
And rather interesting, that wouldn't have that well that would have been harder if Richard de la Pole had still been alive, because he would have had that relationship with Francis, and that kind of sense of unity between them to get him the throne, I suppose.
Well, you'd like to think so, but the French kings had pushed de la Pole to one side before when it suited them. So,
Okay. Well,
yeah.
let's steer this back to closer to the kind of Ricardian story then, in a way. What does the fascinating life and death of Richard de la Pole tell us about the lot of a pretender to a throne at this time? What does it tell us about, what a claimant goes through? Of course, not many years before this, there's yet another famous pretender or claimant to the throne, a fellow known to history as Perkin Warbeck, but who called himself, Richard of England. What does Richard de la Pole's life shed on what happened to this Richard of England?
Well, first of all, it's a pretty precarious existence because he is so reliant on support from elsewhere. The thing about Richard de la Pole is that he does seem to be quite charismatic and enjoy the adventure of it all. But it's really obvious that none of the rulers supporting him were acting out of any genuine sense that this was a man wrongly dispossessed. So you get a lot of rhetoric in the Middle Ages about how you respect the kings who are chosen by God and don't anger God by putting up unsanctioned kings. But what de la Pole's career really highlights is that people only supported him if they thought they could get something out of it. And that's not only true for the other unsuccessful claimants, but even for Henry VII, Henry VI at the re-adaptation, Edward IV when he reclaims the throne. Foreign rulers only support them either because they think they can get some leverage with the existing English king, or because they're hoping that this new king they're putting in place is going to be a better ally for them. I think the other thing about de la Pole that's particularly interesting, if you're wanting to look at the other claimants, is that we've got all these wonderful letters that have survived from Tudor spies reporting on him, so that you can sort of build up a bit of a picture of what was probably going on for earlier cases as well, where there were spies, but the letters don't survive. And so you have these lovely little vignettes about, you know, how Francis I was riding together with Richard de la Pole and saying, oh yes, of course, I absolutely believe you should be the rightful king and I'm going to support you, and that kind of thing. We just don't have those, that kind of little intimate detail for the earlier ones.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much, Joanna. I really appreciate that look into the cover story for next edition. Turning now to Wendy Moorhead. Wendy, you've written a fascinating account of the events of the reinterment week of March 2015, when, of course, Richard III was laid to rest at Leicester Cathedral in the presence of members of the royal family, the patron of the society, the Duke of Gloucester, as well as the Archbishop of Canterbury and many others, not to mention, not least of all, the world's media. Wendy, for the benefits of those of us who weren't there, what was the week like?
Well, it was cold. It involved an awful lot of walking. It was busy, but it was also very, very exciting. There was just so much going on, you really didn't know quite what to choose to go to. Some of it, you've been lucky enough perhaps to have been selected by ballot for an event. Otherwise, there was talks, tours, guided tours. It was just wonderful. The main things, of course, were the three cathedral services. There was the Compline service on the Sunday, there was the reburial on the Thursday, and the reveal on the Friday. But there was also a Requiem Mass at Holy Cross Priory, which is a lovely Catholic church in Newark. And on the Monday evening, just before our own service, there was a Requiem Mass, and the Cardinal of Westminster was there, Vincent Nichols. That was by ballot as well, so not too many people could get there. But they did hold another service. It must have been on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, I think. That was open to the public, and I can remember going along to that. I was actually very tired by this time. We're halfway through the week, and I think I did shut my eyes and snoozed for a moment. But be that as it may, it was memorable. And one of the things that stood out, they brought in a tree. Whether it was an artificial tree or it was a real tree in a pot, I don't know, I can't remember. But it was beautifully illuminated. It literally glowed. And I can remember that so very, very well. Mm. There were so many events, as I've said. There were the society events. Some of them I've spoken about in the feature. We almost took over the Holiday Inn, and we had a buffet meal for members. We had to have two sittings to seat everybody. But that was a great occasion for people to mingle. We had to queue, so once again you got to know people who were in the queues with you. And then you could meet people, and you were at your table or you could circulate. We also had a special members event at the Richard III Visitor Centre, where we got a private viewing. And of course there is that wonderful view of the place where Richard was actually discovered, which has been beautifully preserved within the centre. What else was there? Well, we had the leading lights from the Looking for Richard project.
Yep.
Philippa Langley, John Ashdown Hill, and Annette Carson. They hosted a coffee morning at what was virtually the Society HQ, the Belmont Hotel, situated just a little bit outside the city centre in the cathedral quarter. Hence, there was so much walking involved.
And just to jump in, I mean, is it in the feature, I think you say there, was it 1,000 members of the society, Ricardians, were present in Leicester at some point during the week? Is that about the right figure?
Yeah, I came up with that figure because we had 600 or so in the cathedral on the Monday. And there were other people coming in and out, looking at the numbers of people who had received tickets through the ballot. It was a bit of a rough guess, but I think it was probably around 1,000.
And then, of course, you know, there were thousands of people in the streets of Leicester watching the cortege, Richard's coffin, going to the cathedral. And then, 20,000 people queued up to pay their respects to his coffin as it, you know, laid in rest in the cathedral. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The once the coffin was taken in during before the service at Compline, yep. The following day, the doors opened and they were queuing very, very early. And from the Monday through to the Wednesday, I can't remember when they actually closed the doors on the Wednesday, but yes, there was 20,000 people.
I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, it's astonishing to read about it now, but was it astonishing at the time? Was it genuinely surprising and moving?
Yeah, it was. I'd say it's difficult to... There was just so much happening, but it was absolutely magical. And they say there was just still so much to do. Not only did you have to, could you queue to go and look at the coffin, but you know, if you had transport available, you could go down to the Bosworth Battlefield Heritage Centre. There was guided tours. Interestingly, De Montfort University, their campus is around the Newark area. And there are a number of medieval buildings there. It included the Chantry House, there was the Trinity Hospital Chapel. All of these places were open and they were actually running heritage tours. And they would take you down into their main building and you would go downstairs and there are two arches from the Church of the Annunciation, which had been rebuilt there. And they are just interesting. And this was a church which Richard would have known. May even have been the church he prayed as he left Leicester on his way to Bosworth. We're not sure.
So looking back, you know, from the vantage point of 10 years, what's your sense of what the impact of the week in general, in terms of popular culture, but also in terms of kind of the Ricardian cause of the society?
Well, if you're talking about the significance, obviously the overriding significance was the reburial of an anointed king. He'd only reigned for 2 years, and all this happened 500 years ago. It was such a unique occasion. I mean, it's something that can never be repeated, well, unless they find Henry the First's skeleton. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's quite got the appeal of Richard. What was rather wonderful about it, though, was the lack of negativity, which is something we meet time and time again. And other than possibly a few words in Jon Snow's interviews with people on Channel 4, you didn't really hear anything. There was one or two, I think, debates or discussions about Richard, but perhaps not many people went to them. But what there was the feeling was that we are actually burying or reburying a national hero. And that was the feeling you got if you actually look at the footage of the gun carriage going through, leaving Bosworth and going through the various towns back into Leicester. And then when you actually get into Leicester and the feeling on the streets when those two beautiful horses with their knights in armour preceded the carriage. And this very simple coffin with a very small pall laid over it, it was absolutely electric. And the enthusiasm, obviously a lot of people were Ricardians, a lot of people were tourists, whatever, but there was also an awful lot of the population, the local population there. And they were just so entranced by it and so interested and cheering. It was an experience.
So thank you very much for that, Wendy. It is, of course, a packed edition, and there's a lot more in the March edition than these two features. But one of the other highlights, I think we'll all agree, is an important response we've published from six leading Ricardians to the claims presented in a documentary aired in December, The Princes in the Tower, A Damning Discovery, which featured Professor Tim Thornton of Huddersfield University, Dr. Tracy Borman, and the actor Jason Watkins. Joanna, would you kindly briefly explain what the so-called discovery was in this documentary and why it's potentially damning to the reputation of Richard III?
Yes, so the discovery is a will that was written by a London widow in Henry VIII's reign, in which she mentioned a chain belonging to Edward V that had been her husband's and she was passing on to her son. And it's really unusual to find any evidence of things that belonged to Edward V. And the reason that it was considered to be damning is Tim Thornton's interpretation that you could link it with the fact that the widow, Lady Margaret Capel, her half-sister was married to James Tyrrell. And Sir James Tyrrell was, according to some of the later stories, responsible for the deaths of the princes in the Tower. That's the argument that's being put forward.
Okay, so the argument is because Lady Margaret in 1522 left this chain supposedly belonged to Edward V, and because her half sister was married to James Tyrrell, who is reputedly by Thomas More involved in the death of Edward V, that therefore this is somehow evidence of Richard's guilt.
The theory being that they must have got the chain from James Tyrrell.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. I mean, I won't ask you to summarise all the opinions expressed by the six writers of the piece, because obviously we've got Philippa Langley, Annette Carson, Matt Lewis, Mari Barnfield, the Society Research Officer, Dr. David Grummett, and yourself have all written. But if you could summarise your chief bones of contention with this theory for the benefit of the listeners, I think that would be quite interesting.
Okay, well, I mean, one of the first thing to say is that it's hardly a new discovery. It's been in print for decades. It's been talked about by other historians who never came to the same conclusion. The next thing would be to say that there are lots of ways in which William Capel might have come by this chain. And these are actually mentioned by Professor Thornton in his article that kind of inspired this. There are so many family connections that are possibly linked. But actually, what I think is much more likely is that he acquired it because he was a moneylender, a notorious moneylender. And of course, people had to give him precious objects as collateral for their loans, or sometimes they would pay off their loans with objects like this. And I think that's much more likely how he would have got it. I think the other real issue is that if the Capel family thought James Tyrrell was responsible in some way for Edward V's death, and that they'd got the chain in this way, they would have been horrified. They would not have been advertising owning it in a public document like a will. It just, and if anything, it seems to me this is more evidence that James Tyrrell wasn't involved as far as they knew.
Very good. Okay, so not a discovery and not damning, I think, is the conclusion there. Wendy, if I could bring you in now. I mean, you've obviously been looking at the Ricardian subject for a very long time. As I said earlier, you're a former research officer, and you've written at least 8 articles for the Ricardian journal, by my account anyway. What's your take on the Capel chain claims?
Well, two words come to mind: straw and clutching. I can't say I'm impressed by the documentary.
Yeah,
it was very poor, and I think my colleagues have written everything that really needs to be written. But what it does highlight is how we have to question perceived history and the need for continuing research, which takes us into the Tudor period. Ricardian world did not end on the 22nd of August 1485, far from it. Our work continues, and it continues in the early 16th century.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. That's very interesting. Well, look, we will stop there. Brilliant. Thank you, Joanna Lane-Smith, and thank you to Wendy Moorhen for taking time to talk to this inaugural Bulletin podcast. And thank you to those who are listening to it as well. I should say now, of course, is the new edition of the Bulletin is out in March 2025. And it's, as I said, packed to the rafters with lots of fascinating stuff, not just the topics that we've been talking about just now. Other highlights include a fascinating article by Frederick Hepburn tracing the history of a famous incident concerning a lost Margaret of Anjou and a robber in the woods after the Battle of Hexham in 1464. It's intriguing stuff and just goes to show, rather like Richard de la Pole, that history is stranger than fiction. Just a reminder that this podcast has been brought to you today by the Richard III Society. If you aren't already a member and would like to find out more, you can find us online at our website, which is Richard followed by 3eyes.net. That's Richard III.net. And there's lots more information there about the Society, Richard III, and you can also join there as well. Finally, if you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please do share and pass it on. And that's it then. Until next time, from me, Alec Marsh, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.